At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Omar Al-Khatib, Director, Corporate Affairs and Investor Relations. Please go ahead.
Thank you, operator. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us on our third quarter 2013 conference call. On the line with us today, we have Murad Al-Khatib, President and CEO of Alliance Grain Traders, and Lori Ireland, our Chief Financial Officer. Before we get started, I would like to remind everyone that today's call may include forward-looking statements. Such forward-looking statements are given as of the date of this call and involve certain risks and uncertainties. A number of factors and assumptions were applied in the formulation of such statements, and actual results could differ materially. This call may also include references to certain non-IFRS financial measures. For additional information with respect to forward-looking statements, factors and assumptions, as well as a reconciliation to IFRS measures, we direct you to our news release, our website, as well as our recent filings on SEDAR. With that, I'd like to turn things over to Murad for some comments, and then we'll go to questions. Murad?
Thank you, Omar, and thank you, everyone, for joining our conference call this morning. The current year has been a positive one to date. We're optimistic this will continue with positive tones both for our sector in general and our company in particular. We have spent a lot of time over the past year or so speaking about the necessary conditions for the continued normalization in global pulses and staple food markets. The sector has been hit hard since 2010, with various supply disruptions, macroeconomic headwinds, and other factors that had negatively impacted the sector, and with them, our business and our earnings. Conditions we expected would normalize in 2013, and as we forecasted, signals towards normalization continue to be present in pulses and staple food markets, leading to continued improvement in our earnings. With the Canadian harvest completed, timing on it has been slightly late, which has impacted us somewhat with regard to shipments in the third quarter period. However, these types of timing-related shifts from one quarter to the other is expected and really commonplace. However, quantity is significant and the quality of the crops produced has been good. Product has been flowing into our North American plants. We've been very busy processing and shipping in a period that leads into a traditional busy period for global pulses and staple food markets. At this time, I'm going to call on Lori Ireland, our CFO, to discuss some of the results from our third quarter. Lori?
Thanks, Murad. Hello, we're pleased to report that the quarter ended September 30th, 2013, once again showed an improvement in gross profit, adjusted gross profit, and EBITDA per ton when comparing to both the quarter, the same quarter last year and the prior quarter. Although there was an overall reduction in invoiced tons, EBITDA improved to $14.4 million for the quarter ended September 30, 2013, compared to $13.9 million for the quarter ended June 30, 2013. EBITDA also improved when compared to $11.5 million for the quarter ended September 30, 2012. The pulses and grain processing segment results for the quarter ended September 30, 2013 showed a decrease in invoiced tons, however showed an increase in gross profit, adjusted gross profit, and EBITDA per ton when comparing to the quarter ended June 30th, 2013. This is a result of product mix decisions that resulted in higher margins per ton being recognized. The supply chain management and distribution segment showed a lower gross profit, adjusted gross profit, and EBITDA per ton, and increased tons invoiced in the quarter ended September 30th, 2013, compared to the quarter ended June 30th, 2013. This segment includes traded tons at lower margins, which is offset by higher margin invoice tons through the operations of Portman's and Advanced Seeds. The decrease in the quarter is due largely to low margin sales executed out of Australia in order to make use of empty rail cars. The consolidated margin data is inclusive of all tons transacted on an intercompany basis. There was an excess of 50,000 tons shipped between AGT subsidiaries during the quarter. Overall results for the quarter ended September 30, 2013, showed a 13% improvement in EBITDA per ton when compared to the quarter ended June 30, 2013. We saw an overall reduction in the combined general and administrative and marketing sales and distribution expense in the amount of $1.1 million when comparing the quarter ended September 30, 2013 to the previous quarter. Finance expense decreased for the quarter ended September 30, 2013 compared to the quarter ended June 30, 2013 due to lower utilization of credit facilities throughout the quarter. Non-cash foreign exchange includes a snapshot of outstanding foreign-denominated accounts receivable and accounts payable, as well as outstanding foreign exchange contracts, and includes the contracts related to the high-yield bond. Note that this is a non-cash item and will fluctuate depending on the strength or weakness of foreign currencies when compared to the Canadian dollar. Adjusted earnings per share were 24 cents, basic and diluted. This is an improvement over adjusted earnings per share of 20 cents, basic and fully diluted for the quarter ended September 30, 2012. I want to remind our investors and analysts that AGT tracks adjusted earnings per share as it is reported exclusive of non-cash foreign exchange effects of our global business. Early on in our reporting as a public company, we decided to ensure that these effects were clearly stripped out of our results. Inclusion of both gains and losses that result from snapshot non-cash IFRS effects do not accurately reflect the cash flow generating ability of our business. Net debt increased from $296.1 million at June 30, 2013 to $319.6 million at September 30, 2013 and compared to $267.2 million at December 31, 2012. The increase in net debt of $23.5 million when comparing to June 30, 2013 is the result of increased bank indebtedness and lower cash levels due to significant cash requirements such as the posting of bid, performance, and import tax bonds related to government, United Nations, and non-governmental aid agency tenders and contracts. An increase in property, plant, and equipment related mainly to the completion of the Minot facility also affected the net debt total as of September 30, 2013. The late North American harvest also added to the net debt number, since product procurement activity sped up later on in the quarter and resulted in lower cash balances. Metrics continue to be calculated for each facility, and performance targets are being tied to inventory and accounts receivable turns at each plant and country operations level. Both accounts receivable days outstanding and inventory days outstanding improved when comparing the 9 months ended September 30, 2013 to the year ended December 31, 2012 and to the same period last year. Accounts receivable days outstanding decreased from an average of 70 days for the year ended December 31, 2012 and from 73 days for the 9 months ended September 30, 2012 down to 56 days for the 9 months ended September 30, 2013. Inventory days outstanding decreased from an average of 86 days for the year ended December 31, 2012, and 79 days for the 9 months ended September 30, 2012, down to 77 days for the 9 months ended September 30, 2013. AGT continues to focus on these metrics, as well as on initiatives to lower costs and increase efficiencies. Thank you.
Basically, we see a rise in gross margins per ton and other metrics continuing to improve. As Lori mentioned, our days inventory and accounts receivable outstanding. As a result of the balance sheet and working capital management initiatives we've implemented aimed at increasing the inventory and receivable turns, we've been successful in therefore, you know, reducing, you know, overall cash cycles. And management continues to be focused on reducing working capital debt as a percentage of revenues and equity capital. As we indicated earlier, with the scale and size of operations, margin improvements on existing tons handled through our facilities can have a material impact on improving our earnings going forward. We expect the potential for a robust traditional shipment period ahead in the coming quarters. In fact, we did feel that the Canadian harvest, being one of the largest on record, you know, will certainly allow local market stocks that are continuing to need replenishment to be addressed without supply questions in many key markets. The upcoming shipment periods may be some of the busiest we've seen in our company, which we expect may have positive impact on our earnings and margins. India and the Indian subcontinent have continued to buy from Canada in the period leading up to the new North American harvest, where they're traditionally not in the market. Shipments to Turkey and the Middle East, North Africa region have also been strong as well. Conditions have certainly assisted in bringing supply and demand fundamentals back into balance, which has not been the case for some time, with this balance assisting in the stabilization of prices and the increase in our margins. This is good news for the traditional shipment period later this year and early in 2014. However, the improvement in our core legacy business is not the thing that's giving us the most optimism. With regards to the next phases of growth and development in our company, we continue to be excited about our new food ingredient platform for Pulse's flours, protein, starches, and fibers that we feel positions us for growth and transition from a commodity exporter to a food company. This new business line centers around our Minot, North Dakota facility for the production and distribution of these ingredient products, and our new R&D research center in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, focusing on collaborative research and application development with global food companies and innovation on the uses of pulse ingredients. The Minot facility has completed construction. It's nearly completed on commissioning, with commercial shipments moving out of the plant to satisfy both our marketing agreement with Cargill on pulse protein for branded feed in North America, but also for other global customers looking for a quality supplier of non-GMO, high protein, high fiber ingredients, or new and innovative sources of starch ingredients and flour blends for use in their products, whether for human consumption or for feed, pet food, or aquaculture. We're working hard both with our marketing partner Cargill and through our own sales and marketing channels to make this new business line a significant growth opportunity for AGT to achieve scale in the coming periods. As we develop sales opportunities in this area and complete the ramp-up of the first phase of production, we will make decisions on further planned expansions, such as adding two additional production lines to Minot, or we'll continue to examine the feasibility and cost of conversions of existing available capacity in Canada, in Turkey, and also in the United States. This will assist AGT in ramping up the food ingredient platform in 2014 and 2015. The potential growth trajectory of our ingredient business we expect may allow it to be a material contributor to earnings in 2014 and 15, and we are very excited about the feedback we're getting from global food companies and customers. Our food ingredient business provides the basis for a new segmented reporting in pulse ingredient and packaged foods that we plan to unveil in the fourth quarter of 2013. This new segment may provide meaningful disclosure to our shareholders and the capital markets globally of a platform that we feel has great potential in our transition to potentially higher margin retail and food ingredient business. For some time, we've operated successful retail brands and distribution in Turkey, in Europe, and in Southern Africa. For example, our Arbella pasta brand, we estimate, may be one of the most widely distributed brands of pasta in the global market, being sold in 83 countries and with a number three position in the Turkish domestic market, according to available market data. Our Piyuka's Foods brand is widely distributed through Southern Africa, and our Arbel brand of rices, pulses, and bulgur is distributed throughout Turkey, Central Asia, the Middle East, and Europe. Opportunities to increase the distribution of our milled wheat, rice, popcorn, and other retail products to consumers globally in both the retail and food service sector is an opportunity for this company. We'll continue to examine those opportunities along with further opportunities for private label packaging that may exist through our existing distribution channels. Overall, this business segment will provide us the great potential for growth. Food ingredients, as well as retail and food service, are highly specialized. They appear to be less susceptible to the cyclical patterns in the global commodity business. Our focus in this area comes not only for our desire to expand the business, but also to support the initiatives to diversify, utilize our origination and processing strength, increase our capacity utilization, and ultimately smooth out our earnings throughout the year. Our core legacy business is changing too, as our business concentration moves away from our reliance on lentils and adds more beans, chickpeas, popcorn, rice, durum wheat milling, and other pulses and grains to ensure that we balance our geographies for distribution, our products available for sales, our macroeconomic profiles, and our return profiles. With the addition of the new lines in our legacy business, we're optimistic about our ability to create new sales and revenue opportunities while leveraging our strengths. We expect this will assist us in maintaining a healthy and more predictable earnings profile, generating free cash flow to fund our growth, reduce our debt, and provide value to our shareholders. I thank you for your interest in Alliance Grain Traders. I'm going to turn it back over to Omar to moderate some questions.
Thanks, Murad. Operator, I think we'll take the first question.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone phone. You will hear a tone to indicate you are in queue. For participants using a speakerphone, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing any keys. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star then two. Our first question today comes from Jacob Bout of CIBC. Please go ahead.
Good morning. The improvement that we're seeing in the margin per ton and the pulses and grain processing, maybe you just put it in the buckets of higher volumes versus higher prices versus mix of product. And maybe you can talk a little bit about how much lentils were in the quarter.
Well, Jacob, you know, certainly when you look at the overall tonnages for this quarter being down, you know, I certainly don't think that the improvement that we saw, you know, is a volume driven metric. I mean, you know, certainly if we look at our pulses segment, you know, we're back up into that high 50s range on EBITDA per metric ton in the pulses segment that we disclosed this quarter. So, you know, we're getting back to levels where we were in the 2010 period and, you know, prior to the 2011 financial crisis. You know, I would suggest that, you know, the bulk of that improvement, you know, comes from product mix. And, you know, when we look at the margin compression that we saw, you know, back in the late 11 and 12 period, we were struggling for utilization, period. I mean, taking opportunities in peas and canary seed and in flax seed, you know, for the industrial, you know, solvent markets in China. I mean, we were utilizing plant capacity to generate cash flow. Today, we're back into this mix that, you know, it took time to build. I mean, you can't become the world's largest chickpea shipper, you know, to balance your lentil platform overnight. It took us, you know, 2 years of, you know, effort on distribution. You know, some of the CapEx that we spent was on facility revisions to ensure we could, you know, handle chickpeas in multiple geographies. So you're seeing the benefits of that strategy piece, that even in the tough earnings cycle, Jacob, we were, you know, investing in a way to ensure that, you know, we brought lentils down to, you know, our target would be that it should make up, you know, less than one third of our total, you know, geographic revenue. And not that there's anything wrong with our lentil profile, but, you know, the bottom line is when you're 25 to 28% of the world trade of a particular commodity, you know, when that commodity does go into a cycle, you end up in a position where you're susceptible to earnings volatility. I mean, the entire game here for us is stability of our earnings. And, you know, that's why, again, I think that the chickpea, bean, rice, and durum wheat milling, you know, are really good balances, you know, for the traditional legacy business, you know, of lentils. And when you add in, you know, the first tons of the food ingredient, that probably had a small effect on the gross margins and the earnings that we saw in that segment. But you know, certainly, Jacob, I wouldn't characterize price gains as contributing, because really, actually, we saw the opposite. In the third quarter, we had significant price deceleration. And so, you know, for some of our analysts, part of the thesis is that in order for our earnings to be strong or our margins to be strong, we need commodity price acceleration. Once again, in quarter three, we showed that in a significant deceleration environment, we had improved margins. So, again, long answer, Jacob, but really it's product mix. It continues to product mix and geographies, I think those would be the two things that really contributed. I mean, the geographic strategy is aimed at, you know, if we were entirely a North American and an Australian company this quarter, we wouldn't have had such strong earnings because we were a very late harvest. You know, we had significant price deceleration in North America on the pulses side in terms of prices, which left the available stocks that were in hand in tight hands, because farmers were anticipating that if there was a late harvest, there was the potential for quality problem. So product wasn't coming freely. What balanced us, Turkey had a strong performance. Southern Africa had a strong performance. China, India, and Europe all performed very well. So that gave us a strong earnings balance. That's part of the goal long term.
So So just as a follow-up here, just on the mix then, if you're comparing year-on-year, what was that the change in mix, say, year-on-year, lentils, peas, beans, and rice, roughly?
Well, you can see that, you know, in our segmented revenue, you know, you can see that the other segment is actually very strong here. And so the other, meaning the rice and other commodities, you know, we've been putting a lot of effort on the rice side with our mill, and also on import and distribution of rice. The United Nations business related to a distribution of staples in different refugee relief programs have contributed as well. I'd say, you know, lentils were probably down to that 35% range. If we look at it a year ago, we were probably at 55%.
Certainly
an ability to diversify.
And the doubling of the tonnage in the supply side management, but yet earnings being halved, what was the driver there?
Yeah, Laurie mentioned, you know, the rail side of Australia. You know, Australia is a very interesting country in that we end up in a position where, you know, transportation from inland locations is very different than it is in Canada. I mean, in Canada, we have, you know, the two national railways. We have, you know, feast and famine service, depending on what's going on in the dynamics of the economy. In Australia, we have to create the transportation. And so in our New South Wales operation in particular, we have a take-or-pay rail contract. So when we're at the end of commodity cycles and there are no, you know, pulses left in the system and we're waiting for a new crop harvest, you know, we have to resort to cereals, sorghum, you know, other products going into that chain so that we don't pay empty rail freight. So, you know, certainly, you know, that would have been one of the contributors was, you know, boost in volumes to basically to avoid penalties, you know, on the rail contract. Now, the good news is we only see that phenomenon in quarter three, that by quarter four, again, we're back shipping rail capacity that is related to the new harvest.
The next question comes from Steve Hansen of Raymond James. Please go ahead.
Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah.
Hi.
Yeah, good morning, Ron. Can you maybe just help me understand the tonnage metrics around these conversion opportunities that you've outlined a little more clearly? I understand the Minot facility could scale to just over 100,000 tons of the two new lines, but talk me through perhaps the conversion opportunities in Canada and Turkey and just how the tonnage would sort of fall out.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously the pace of conversion, you know, this would be the first time we gave you a little bit of visibility, you know, into our view of, you know, the pace. And you know, our goal at this point, and it'll obviously be driven by sales opportunity, but our goal is to ramp up utilization of facilities that we've built and lines that we've built. And the minute we have a view as management that we have a, you know, a sustainable, clear view towards full utilization, we're going to be adding incremental capacity. So this is, you know, I can tell you that the first plant and the first line, you know, was certainly, there was some visibility with the Cargill agreement that we signed, but it was a build it and they will come type mentality. We had no choice. We had to build the first facility. So Cargill helped us to diversify that risk that, you know, we knew there was going to be some demand coming for that line from the first day of production. You know, assuming, of course, that we could not only build it, operate it, but we could deliver the specification, which we've done successfully. From there, it's all about building. So 35,000 tons is the capacity of line one in Minot. We can add two additional production lines. And, you know, the CapEx cost of that is likely in the range of around $7 million total. So, you know, once you build the large-scale infrastructure, storage, buildings, receiving pits, warehouses, you literally have to plop in two lines, connect them, and commission them, and you're ready to go in 90 days. So our first goal will be to get Minot to a full, you know, 100 to 115,000 tons of full utilization, and then we'll look at conversion opportunities incrementally. There's really, you know, three plants that would be, you know, the main conversion targets. That would be, you know, Regina splitting plant, the Turkish splitting operations or portions thereof, and Williston, North Dakota. So we do have a second North Dakota opportunity, you know, that that we could also look at conversion. And The conversion, if we look at our splitting plants, with the exception of Turkey, which would be around 300,000 tons of capacity, we have literally about 100 to 120,000 tons at each location. So, you know, they're well suited to either do a full conversion or a partial conversion. Now, in my mind, it's all going to come down to the metrics of what we're delivering margin-wise. If we are in a position where we literally are delivering a margin profile that is significantly superior to the legacy business, it will warrant, and demand, of course, is there sustainably, it will warrant us to look at conversion. And so the plan will be to look at the pace of conversion related to the commercial market development of the sales program. Now, Canada would likely be a conversion target, you know, early on, because we do expect that the growth in sales opportunities are going to be from both the United States and Europe. Now, we do have a significant opportunity ahead of us in that the recently announced Harper government Canada-Europe trade agreement contains provisions within it that actually reduce taxes and duties on pulses, flours, and fractions to zero in certain products and down from, you know, 12-13% down to 7% and then phasing out over time. So market access out of Canada into Europe is going to be a very enhanced opportunity going forward. So, you know, if you basically take that, we could take the 100,000 tons at Minot. We'd have a goal by, you know, 14, 15 into 16. You know, I'd like to see us, you know, double the capacity through a conversion and then triple it.
The next question comes from Christine Healy of Scotiabank. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Hi, guys. We saw a nice decline in AR this quarter. Was that largely due to a change in your terms where you're collecting sooner from your customers? And was any of it related to taking more off the balance sheet through factoring? If you could just talk to the sustainability of that AR improvement, that'd be helpful. Thanks.
I can give a perspective, but Lori, do you want to go first or go ahead, Lori?
Yeah, I think, you know, it was a combination of both. We are, you know, we do have a couple different AR programs, you know, that we're working on. We're trying to, you know, tighten up our terms with our customers. And the factoring would have contributed somewhat, but not a huge amount. I think the biggest thing was in quarter two, near the end of quarter two, we had quite a bit of invoicing done from Canada and Australia. And in both those areas, the, you know, quarter three really focused on collecting from those invoices.
Okay.
I think certainly, Christine, terms are tightening, and we can see, you know, when I look at the overall, you know, gains, you know, the inventory turn gain from 80, I think it was 86 days at the worst to 77, you know, we got work to do there to continue to move that along. But the AR side, you know, I'm quite pleased to get down to a cash cycle on our AR collection of 56. You know, when you're considering, you know, a lot of cases, cash against document sales with a transit time of up to, you know, 40 to 50 days. So when we're doing a lot of West Coast Vancouver shipping into the Med region, because even though it's very counterintuitive, Montreal to Europe, Middle East is about, say, 28 to 30 days transit. And from Vancouver, it's about 47 days transit. But I would say over the last 9 months, 75% of our volume destined for the Mediterranean region is going via Vancouver because the freight rates are actually quite a bit more competitive. So with a 47-day transit time and a 56-day cash cycle, we've tightened terms. And this was all part of what we went back to our distribution to say is when times were tough, we supported our distribution as a necessity of continuing the healthy, you know, development of our distribution network for future periods' earnings. When things started to improve, everybody has to pay their own way. And we're not a bank, and we make that very, very clear to our clients, and that is not a thing that will change. Now, on the factoring and the other things that Lori mentioned, I'd consider those sustainable gains too. Because those programs aren't one-times, they're actually factoring lines that actually replenish themselves as those receivables are collected and dropped off. So they're non-recourse factoring lines. But once we drop off a large receivable that we've factored, then we can actually refactor another one. So these gains will certainly, continue.
The next question comes from Mark Robinson of Cormark Securities. Please go ahead.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
So the segmented results, there's a pretty big decline in the Asian business, offset by a very big increase in Middle East, North Africa. So we don't have the export figures yet, but for September. But so, I mean, can you comment a little bit on whether you're seeing weakness into India already? And then, a little bit of color on what's happening in your traditional MENA markets as it relates to a recovery there.
Yeah, good question, Mark. So, first comment I would make is, part again of this, of the development strategy over, 9, 10, 11, 12, even in this whole difficult period of earnings, was to ensure that we had, augmented and refined our distribution around the world. And, interestingly, when I look at the financial crisis of 8 and 11, there's one benefit that it did bring to this company. What it did do was it actually refined our distribution system, where the stronger importers that we stood behind and supported and who honored their obligations have become stronger in their markets and have become a lot more connected to AGT in a lot of cases. So, from that perspective, we have the ability to move around the world in a normalized, supply-demand fundamentals, where we're getting back to that normalized supply-demand, and we're able to generate our margin, exclusive of one region, being the large driver. So, India in the quarter three period actually went through a very, negative type of profile where, the Indian rupee decline was rapid from a 56 down to a 69, and then it came back to around 62, 63 where it stays today. So, as a result of that, we're very much in tune with the risk profile of our markets. In particular now we have AGT India, where we have, 11 full-time staff on the ground now. We're very in tune with the liquidity and the currency effects that this has on large-scale distribution. We scaled our program back. We anticipated the problems, the defaults, the, currency, devaluation effects on liquidity of some of the import chains, and we diverted our efforts to Middle East, North Africa. And so that's why you saw a bit of a decline. The good news is with the recovery back to 62, we're now into the traditional shipping period. And, pulses are consumed in general when temperatures do get cooler. This is a larger consumption period, in particular in a lot of markets, say the Middle East and North Africa. When it gets cold at night, people drink lentil soup. They eat more pulses in their diets, beans and chickpeas. So the traditional shipping period, is coming up with India in a bit of a stable, a situation today. So we've seen the resumption of demand in India. Middle East, North Africa region, very dynamic. You read a lot in the news, recently about it. And, what I would characterize it as is post-conflict benefit for AGT. Now, during the conflict period of 2011, Arab Spring, 2012, the hangover effects of both the political and the economic instability that came with Arab Spring and the political unrest, came a devaluation in currencies and a problem on our earnings in our core region. And we can't forget that this company, AGT, and especially with the Arbel acquisition we did in 2009, that is our backyard. So the Middle East, North Africa is certainly one of the lifebloods of this company in terms of strength of our distribution. We're seeing the benefit now where post-conflict stability programs, the United Nations refugee programs that Lori mentioned in her comments, these are adding significant, and robust demand, into our mix today. So that's why you see a big gain in our segmented other revenue category. Where, the Turkish facilities in the port city of Mersin are perfectly situated for import reprocessing, repackaging. You know, we're doing things, Mark, like what's called family parcel sales, where we're actually taking, you know, up to 8 to 12 commodities and packaging them into master packages for United Nations, International Red Cross, and other NGO distribution. Now, as, you know, analysts and investors, I want to be clear on one thing. I'm very happy to be contributing to the efforts of the United Nations and international aid agencies. But for us, it's a very significant business. And as one of the largest suppliers into that system, our infrastructure is well suited to it. And we're very competitive with very large scale. We expect that to continue.
The next question comes from Anup Prahar of GMP Securities. Please go ahead.
Good morning. Just two questions on Minot. At the end of Q3, line one was about two-thirds utilization. Where are we on that metric today? And then second of all, with respect to line two, it's the same size as line one. So how much of line two's production would you have to have committed before you would feel comfortable advancing with the capital required to build that one?
Yeah, good question, Anup. I mean, you know, from the end of the quarter, I would say, you know, in the last few weeks of the quarter, we were definitely ramping production up. And as I said, we got to about that two-thirds utilization. You know, we've continued to advance our program in October and into November. And so, you know, part of that is not only having, you know, client trialing of the commercial production. So we need to have the large-scale clients, you know, take their first orders, put it into their commercial production, and give us the green light to look at, you know, longer or larger supply agreements. The progress has been quite, you know, positive, so we have no issues on any of those types of things. The ramping up, you know, has advanced past the two-thirds utilization. We are, you know, further training, you know, new staff. I expect that by the end of November, we'll move the plant up to 24-hour-a-day production from its current 18 to 20 hours. And so, you know, before year-end, I would expect that we should be at full utilization of that particular line. In terms of what we need for line two, when line one is running and sold, you know, these sales are not like the legacy business. You know, success breeds success, and it's stickier revenue, and it's stickier, you know, earnings, where users of these products are not commodity users. There's a reason they're using the product, and as they integrate it into their product mix and ingredient mix, we see it expanding. You know, for instance, I'll give you an example. You know, a meat company in the United States, you know, took product for a breadcrumb replacement application, they took our high-viscosity flour, and they told us very honestly they were going to introduce it into one particular product to replace the breadcrumb to make it gluten-free. And once they took the product and tested it and liked it and went to commercial production, they advised us that their R&D group is now testing for 8 additional products. And different applications, you know, can move from breadcrumb to, you know, soy replacement, you know, is another application that this meat company is looking at. So you end up in a position where, you know, the sales visibility, you know, becomes, you know, apparent from the sales program. So, you know, I think we were quite clear in our desire to get there and allocate the capital as quickly as we can. But I want to be very clear to the market. You know, we're not building these things to talk about the fact that they're not utilized. And so we are going to take a very managed approach on our capital allocation. Good news is that every line of capital now is, you know, $3.5 million. So, you know, the big bulk of the CapEx has already been made. So I'd expect to give you, you know, further updates throughout quarter four or into, you know, quarter one for the expansions, Anup.
So what has to happen then before you decide to proceed with line two?
Well, I can tell you that I'm not in Regina at our head office today because I've spent the last couple of days traveling in the United States and in Canada meeting with large-scale clients. And, you know, we're starting to get to a point where, you know, we're discussing 2014 requirements with those clients. And so when we start to have application acceptance of our ingredients, that drives us to a point where, as I say, that visibility is becoming much more clear. So, you know, what has to happen, Anoop, is just, you know, a little bit of time where, you know, we've now been, I would say, if I said in the MD&A that we were nearing completion on commissioning, I'd tell you that we're commissioned on line one now. So, you know, what the final stage of commissioning for us was just the final tweaks. You know, the things I look at, Anoop, are, is it producing to the quantity I thought it would? Is it producing to the quality I thought it would? And is it producing at the efficiency that I thought it would? Because those three metrics drive into your economic model on the return profile, on our return on both invested capital and the working capital required to run it. I'm getting a very strong comfort level in all of those metrics, and the sales side is becoming you know, much more clear. The opportunity in protein and fiber, you know, we today I feel like we would have you know, an ability to sell all we could produce in Minot, even in three lines. But the starch, the high viscosity flour, is the sales opportunity that we have to develop, and that's progressing well.
As a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then one on your touchtone telephone. Our next question comes from Stephen Ottridge of BMO Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Yeah, good morning, everyone. Wheat flour consumption has fallen to a 22-year low, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. This is obviously the partly due to the work of gluten-free products out there. Do you anticipate a large-ish increase in this? Are you foreseeing that into the future?
Yeah, very good question, and you know, thank you for asking it. I mean, you know, for those of you who've been following this story, you know, you'll know that we have been you know, talking about, you know, gluten-free and non-GMO, you know, as a main attribute of Pulses. And I can tell you one thing. Gluten-free and non-GMO was not high on the minds of Indian, Pakistani, Sri Lankan, Arabs, Turks who were eating these products every day. They were eating them because of the traditional nature of the commodities and the fact that they are staples within their diets. But AGT has been talking about gluten-free and non-GMO because of the trend that we were seeing, you know, develop throughout the North American, Western European, you know, and other more developed geographies in the world in terms of you know, both retail and consumer food markets. So, you know, this gluten-free trend, you know, in the United States, I think there's going to be a couple of things, both in the U.S. and in Europe. I think we're going to see a continued move towards, you know, the development of good tasting or properly tasting gluten-free products. I mean, today one of the challenges is that if you have a gluten allergy, so you're celiac, or if you have a gluten intolerance, meaning that, you know, you are having some sort of ailment from digestive or otherwise from the consumption of gluten, the product choice, the product quality, and in particular, the palatability, the taste profile, and the texture of these products is off. It's not, you know, as developed. Now, it's getting better dramatically quickly, and that's an R&D, you know, product development type of thing. We see that the profile as one that is going to continue, and we don't think that this is a fad diet-y type thing. In fact, I think I saw an article, I think it was, you know, maybe Bloomberg, don't quote me on the source, but it actually attributed the reduction in gluten trend as a, you know, a fad diet kind of, or a special diet kind of a characterization. We think this is a sustainable trend. We think that, you know, consumers who are not celiac or gluten intolerant still will continue to have a perception that they would like to reduce their gluten. And so we're seeing food companies reacting with a desire for gluten-free ingredients that provide them with a different nutritional profile as well. What we love about our pursuit in the food ingredients is that we're marketing it as protein and as fiber. And really what we're marketing is that ingredient that is protein and fiber but that has the gluten-free benefit. And so, you know, when we look at what we see happening And I have to switch to Europe for a second. Europe, you know, areas in particular in the United Kingdom have the highest rates of celiac allergy per capita of any region in the world. So we see this trend continuing. I have to mention the non-GMO as well. I mean, in Europe, of course, that's a very big opportunity, but we're seeing a significant traction in the United States on non-GMO. And you know, some of you may have read, you know, groups coming out criticizing, you know, different breakfast cereal brands because of their use of genetically modified corn. And so we see this trend there as a natural, clean deck type product. So clean deck meaning, you know, not modified ingredients, not, you know, solvent extracted ingredients, clean deck, natural ingredients, not necessarily organic, can be conventional, but natural as a significant growth, you know, industry. And we expect that to grow by the tens of millions of dollars in the coming, you know, 3 to 5 year period. That's the wheelhouse that we're fitting into. And that's the strength and the pace that we're going to see on the ramp up of this food ingredient initiative. Because no one has ever produced pulse ingredients at a high volume with a consistent specification on an economically competitive basis. And, you know, from that perspective, I think, you know, that's going to be the driver of the initiative.
The next question comes from John Chu of AltaCorp Capital. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning.
Morning, John.
A couple of questions on just the post-ingredient Minot. For lines 2 and 3, can you build just line 2 separately, or does it make sense to do 2 and 3 together just in terms of cost savings? And how do you look at that going forward?
John, we've built out so that literally when you come and tour the plant, you're going to see, you know, a block space for line 2 and a block space for line 3. You know, you even will look up at the wall and see the spouts that are connecting to the air system are already spouted and ready. So we literally can put in line 2 independently and line 3 independently. You know, with only a 90 to 120 day cycle to commissioning,
mm-hmm.
I would expect them to stage. So again, there's no reason, even though it's only 3 to 3.5 million of capital, you know, we are going to spend the capital, utilize the line. Once the second line gets to, you know, again, that's 2/3 utilization, and I can see that it's moving towards full utilization, then it's time to pull the trigger on the next line. So we'll keep staging. So I see that being the staging where, you know, if this works out as I think it may, you know, we have the opportunity to potentially, you know, ramp utilization every, you know, 1 or 2 quarters where you start to end up developing more and more opportunities. So you start to scale lines every 3 to 6 months. If we do that over the course of 3 years, even 2 years, you'll build some significant scale and make it, as I put in my comments, a material contributor to earnings.
And how much would it cost to convert the Canadian, the Regina, or the Williston facility, and then similar with the Turkish facility, given that it's...
Yeah, I'm expecting that conversion costs will probably run in the range of about $12 to $15 million versus a you know, greenfield build that cost us in excess of $30 million when we ramp up the other lines. In fact, with the two additional lines, you'd probably be somewhere around $35 million. So, yeah, probably $12 to $15 million. So you're adding, you know, another 100,000 tons of capacity for a significantly lower capital cost. Now, I have to make a comment on why did I build a greenfield when I had extra capacity that I could have converted. I just want to make it clear. We made the decision early, and it was the right decision. The first plant with a focus on U.S. food companies is a U.S. origin product factory. We have no border issues. We have no supply chain issues to do just-in-time delivery. And we wanted no reason for a food company to be cautious or worried about the supply chain coming from a Canadian plant into a U.S. food manufacturing sector. So that's why Minot made sense to be the first. But the conversions beyond that, I would expect, you know, Canada and Turkey will be, you know, either number 2 or number 3 moving between the two of them.
As an additional reminder, please press star then 1 if you have a question. The next question is a follow-up from Steve Hansen of Raymond James. Please go ahead.
Yeah, Murad, just to follow up on the type of agreements you expect to sign on a go-forward basis. The Cargill agreement is a great sort of bedrock foundation for the platform, but should we expect other five-year type agreements from some of these other food and feed or agriculture-related companies, or are they going to be more one-off stage contracts with no real high-level visibility for us as analysts?
You know what, Steve, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, it really depends on how we choose the food distribution side of this business, because you know, one strategy will be to have one or two, you know, commercialization partners, as we did in the pet food, branded feed ingredient, and aquaculture sectors, and the protein side with Cargill. So we're examining, you know, the complementarity of some of the ingredient, you know, companies in the world that, you know, have expressed interest in more distribution and joint collaborative development type agreements. And so we'll be looking at that and making decisions in the coming, you know, one or two quarters. With relation to the clients, you know, I can tell you that, you know, we have, you know, joint development, you know, non-disclosure R&D agreements with a number of major food companies already in place. And those will lead to supply agreements. Those supply agreements will not be clearly visible to analysts. I mean, under confidentiality rules, you know, with those agreements, you can appreciate that, you know, a large-scale, you know, breakfast cereal company or a pasta manufacturer would not want, you know, the world to know that they have a long-term supply contract with one particular ingredient supplier. But just as one more follow-up on that, Steve, you're going to see it ramping, though. So you're not going to see necessarily this announcement, but you're going to see a segment where you're going to see tonnages disclosed, margins, you know, earnings profiles. So, you know, I can tell you that my feeling is that that revenue, I keep using the word sticky and, you know, really, you know, not susceptible to those macroeconomic conditions. That's what we like about this segment. You know, they don't change because we become a foundation ingredient in a blend or a product that's branded.
We have an additional follow-up question from John Chu of AltaCorp Capital. Please go ahead.
Hi, Murad. Just two quick questions here. Has Cargill been doing any testing on the food side, or has it just been on the pet food?
Sorry, John, you have to repeat your question.
Sure. Has Cargill been doing taking any product to test on food, or has it just been on the pet side?
Yeah, you know what, John, I like in terms of specific companies, you know, testing and utilization, I can't really make any comments. But, you know, what I can tell you is that, you know, we have, you know, a very large list of food companies that are, you know, buying product already and in testing phases. So we're quite happy with the progress that we have there.
Okay. And then just lastly, the product mix that you have, you're saying Lentos are 35%. Just curious, how low do you think that can get going forward? Can we get to less than 30 or 25?
I would expect that, you know, COO, myself and our executive chairman and Lori, when we sat down, you know, we had targeted it to be around, you know, somewhere between a quarter and a third. And, you know, once again, I keep reiterating because I feel like the guy who started a lentil platform and took it into a global platform defends it. Lentils are a very good business. They're a foundation business of our legacy business. The issue of the reducing the concentration was just as we grow, you know, it just makes sense for us not to have to push revenue or utilization through that platform, eroding our own margins. We actually get a chance now to sit back and say, you know, I'm not going to do lentils at that plant because I have more than my share of green pea sales into the canning and snack food markets. So this factory can utilize, you know, that in green peas. Or, you know what, I've got B90 chickpeas that can run at this factory instead of lentils. And we actually saw that over the course of quarter three where, you know, with the Indian currency devaluation, we had plants that we were wholesale changing over to things like chickpeas. You know, canary seed has actually been quite a strong commodity for us over the past 6 months. you know, where it we've seen some very good opportunities on bagged and packaged canary seed. We don't talk about it a lot, but we have a bird food ingredient business that we own through the Portman's London operation in the United Kingdom, where, you know, we're a major supplier of bird food ingredients. So the reduction in lentils down to 33%, down maybe to 30, maybe coming as low as 25, you know, I think that's a good balance. If one commodity with multiple sub-commodities is a quarter or a third of your revenue, I think that's a, you know, a good position, but I want to be diversified.
Well, thanks a lot, Murad. And that brings us to the end of our questions in the session. I'd like to thank you all for joining us on our call today. I'd like to remind everyone that's still on the call that if you have any follow-up questions, you can feel free to contact us at our Regina head office, and we'd be more than happy to follow up with you. Again, thanks for attending our conference call, and I wish you all a very good day.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect your lines. Thank you for participating, and have a pleasant day.